Hello, and thank you for listening to the AT Tapes, a podcast from the Journal of Athletic Training. The goal of this podcast is to interview researchers and clinicians on current topics facing athletic trainers and discuss how we can utilize best practices to improve patient outcomes. My name is Lizzie Hibbard, and I will be your host. Currently, I am a faculty member in the athletic training program at the University of Alabama, and I have a research interest in shoulder and elbow injury prevention in youth overhead athletes. You can follow me on Twitter at EE Hibbard. Before getting started on today's episode, I want to remind everyone that all content from JAT is open access, meaning it is free of charge to all readers thanks to funding from the National Athletic Trainers Association. Let's get started with the interview with Dr. Torres McGahey. In today's episode, we will be discussing the female athlete triad with Dr. Toni Torres McGahey. She is an associate professor and the associate dean for diversity, equity, and inclusion in the Arnold School of Public Health at the University of South Carolina. Dr. Torres McGahey's research interests include sports nutrition, eating disorders, body image, and female athlete triad. Dr. Torres McGahey, thank you for joining us and welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. I'm welcome to be here.
Thanks. Is it okay if I call you Toni?
Absolutely.
All right, perfect. As we get started, can you tell us a little bit about your educational background and career path to your current role?
Yes, absolutely. I am originally from Gallup, New Mexico. I started my academic career path at a junior college called Cochise College in Douglas, Arizona, where I was also a student athlete. So once I completed my 2 years at Cochise College, I knew I wanted to continue to play basketball and finished my basketball career and my bachelor's degree in biology slash kind of sports medicine was my minor at Southern Utah University, followed by my master's degree at Texas Tech University. And then I worked clinically for a few years and finished my doctoral degree at the University of Alabama in exercise physiology.
Interesting. So can you tell us a little bit about how you became an athletic trainer and what your educational background or where you did your education for athletic training?
First, when I went to junior college, I had no idea really what I wanted to do with as a career. And like I said before, I was a student athlete. And my original thoughts were maybe I'll start off and think about computer engineering. And my first year was my first experience ever with an athletic trainer. And he wanted to teach an intro to athletic training class and recruited all the student athletes in the class, you know, at the institution to be in the class. And so I was like, why not? I'll try it. And then I absolutely loved it. I loved learning about athletic training and how to prevent and treat injuries. And so my second year, he had a work study position open and asked if I would do work study and work in the athletic training clinic. And so I said yes, and at the same time played basketball. Well, obviously I couldn't get a degree in athletic training there. So I knew I wanted to continue to play basketball. And when I looked at other schools that were recruiting me, I made sure I selected a school that I was able to do athletic training as well.
In addition to your role working clinically, you have done quite a bit of research throughout your career. Can you tell us about your research interests and how these evolved over your professional career through some of your clinical experiences?
Absolutely. When I was at Texas Tech, I finished my master's degree there and worked clinically for 3 years at Wayland Baptist University. And during that time, I was an adjunct at Texas Tech teaching exercise physiology at the undergraduate level and working with some of the faculty and helping them with some of their research while being the head athletic trainer. So I was pretty busy. And during that time, I really piqued an interest in nutrition and heat and hydration. And so when I decided to work on my PhD, that's what I originally thought I wanted to focus on until I had a change of heart while at the University of Alabama. It was originally after our first football game. It was the first football game that I worked and also the last football game that was held at Legion Field in Birmingham. And I worked as a host athletic trainer with our program director. And we were on the sideline and there were football players just dropping like flies. It was hot, it was humid. And so I was like, wow, I'm at the right place at the right time, working in the South and, you know, studying heat and hydration. This is going to be great. Well, the next, after that game on Monday, our sports medicine director came to our office, the doctoral student office, and he just got out of a meeting with our program director, and they both came out and said, you know, we really need one of you to volunteer to work with the Million Dollar Band. And of course, we all looked at each other like, are you crazy? Like, why does the band need an athletic trainer? Well, lo and behold, during that same game, they also had a lot of issues with heat and hydration. So I said, well, you know, it's in my kind of what I want to study, so I will do that. And I volunteered, but while I was volunteering with them over the semester and over that first year, I noticed there were so many other things that I was treating. We had a lot of psychological issues we were treating. We had some disordered eating behaviors and previous eating disorders. And so really at that time, working clinically with them changed my mind on what I wanted to focus on moving forward. And hence why I started my research line in nutrition, eating behaviors, disordered eating, and really looking at the mental health aspects of student athletes and dancers.
So with your line of research, what do you consider to be your lab?
I really focus on identifying exercising females and even now so males with energy deficiencies as they pertain to energy availability, or, you know, they definitely have to be people who are exercising regularly or our own student athletes who exercise daily. And then the secondary goal of my lab is really to identify any mental health and wellness issues that are associated at the collegiate and with recreational athletes. So within that realm, we'd look a lot at the female athlete triad components, which primarily looks at, you know, energy intake, energy availability, exercise energy expenditure. We look at bone health as it relates to bone mineral density. And we also identify eating disorder risk or disordered eating risk and any other comorbid behavioral health issues such as depression, anxiety. Definitely, we deal a lot with body image issues with our student athletes and our recreational athletes that come through our lab, and identify any weight pressures as well.
So we know that disordered eating is well documented in both recreational and professional female exercisers and can lead to chronic energy insufficiency. So before we really begin discussing the role of the athletic trainer in managing disordered eating and female athlete triad, I think it's really important that we define some of the terms so that we're all using the appropriate language. Can you start by defining disordered eating and eating disorders and discussing some of the similarities and differences in that terminology?
Yes, absolutely. Eating disorders and disordered eating are often used interchangeably, and they really shouldn't be used interchangeably. When we look at eating disorders should be identified by diagnosed by a physician, and they have to meet specific criteria by the DSM-5. And so it's very important for clinicians to not only understand what these definitions are, but they also need to understand the criteria that the patient must meet in order to fully be diagnosed with an eating disorder. Disordered eating, on the other hand, I you know, in class when I teach my students, I tell them all the time, I think everybody has some form of disordered eating. You know, whether we don't like breakfast, we skip meals, we don't like leafy green things, but it becomes detrimental when those behaviors lead to an actual eating disorder that could potentially be diagnosed by a physician. And so it's really important to note that one, they have to be diagnosed by the guidelines and the criteria met by the DSM-5. And for the most part, anything else could be really considered disordered eating. On top of that, we must really understand what pathogenic behaviors are. There sometimes are misconceptions of what a pathogenic behavior is and what's considered purging. And purging is entailed by a lot of different mechanisms. So purging can be anything from excessive exercise to self-induced vomiting. And we also have to look at other pathogenic behaviors such as dieting, using laxatives to control weight, as well as any other supplement that can be used.
So in addition to disordered eating and eating disorders. We're also going to be talking about female athlete triad today. So will you define this for us as well as the components of female athlete triad?
There's a lot of literature on the female athlete triad, and I believe we have a little over 30 years of published evidence to support its clinical sequelae. And so it was initially termed the female athlete triad in the early 90s, and by the late 90s is when they came up with the term amenorrhea, osteoporosis, and eating disorders was a triad, with the eating disorders being on the top corner, and then amenorrhea and osteoporosis. And in 2007, there was a revision of the female athlete triad position stand, and they then changed that definition to really reflect what they were seeing clinically with athletes with the triad. And so with that being said, they really changed it into a spectrum. So we started out with like optimal energy availability and eumenorrhea and optimal bone health as really our normal state and where we want all our student athletes. And then it included a lot of clinical, subclinical disorders throughout the spectrum, with our most detrimental being low energy availability with or without an eating disorder, possibly functional hypothalamic amenorrhea, and then osteoporosis. But what we've seen more frequently in the diagnosis of the female athlete triad were really more of those subclinical disorders. And so it's very, very important for athletic trainers to be able to diagnose and see what those subclinical disorders are. And I think that's where we most commonly make a mistake in diagnosing the triad.
So going off of low energy availability, as part of the definition of female athlete triad, can you tell us what this means and how it relates to clinical diagnosis?
So low energy availability is defined as our total daily energy intake minus our exercise energy expenditure. And this is all the energy available after exercise for all of our metabolic and physiological processes. And so there is a lot of literature and evidence to support that when a female, particularly a female, has low energy availability, which is defined as less than negative 30 kilocalories per kilogram of fat-free mass, that we are starting to see some physiological changes and changes to female reproductive function, as well as metabolism and even bone health.
So what is the role of the athletic trainer in managing athletes with disordered eating, female athlete triad, or any of these disorders on the spectrum?
Well, the athletic trainer is really a key clinician in diagnosing the female athlete triad or eating disorders. They tend to be the person that sees the student athlete most frequently, so they can help identify their eating patterns, changes in mood, changes in personality, and how they're interacting with their team, and even more importantly, some changes within their performance. And so it's very important for them to understand those definitions of what an eating disorder is, what is disordered eating, and are they at risk for either? Are they engaging in pathogenic behaviors? And do they really understand what the female athlete triad is and some of these clinical, subclinical disorders that might be associated with it? So it's very important for them to participate as a multidisciplinary team and to help develop, in conjunction with the team physician, clear parameters and a rationale for the athlete's treatment, the athlete's return to play criteria, and really it should be collectively all of the healthcare providers that are taking care of this particular patient, which can vary depending on the severity. It's also very important for them to facilitate information flow between the healthcare providers, because what we tend to see sometimes is there's a drop in communication between maybe the dietitian or the psychologist or psychiatrist and the family practice physician that might be overseeing their general health. So it is important for all of those clinicians to communicate and making sure that they are all making good decisions, specifically when it's time for return to play, that's in the best interest of the student athlete. The one other thing I think it's important for the athletic trainer to do is to make sure that they are that person communicating with whether it's the strength conditioning coach or the coach themselves to help clarify the workout regimen that is being expected of the student athlete. It's very important to understand how much that student athlete is expending, and it might be that might be one of the restrictions is to lessen the amount of exercise that they're in, that they are partaking in each day. So they need to be able to clarify workouts and make sure they're on the same page as the coach as well as the strength conditioning coach.
So when you're talking about being able to identify individuals maybe that have low energy availability, are there ways for clinicians to easily do this in a clinical setting?
There are easy ways to do it. And in our lab, we try to do a lot of the measurements that we do are really based off of what we would be able to see that a clinician would be able to do. And so, for example, dietary intake, that's fairly simple now nowadays to monitor daily food intake because there's so many great apps that can use. And what I tell clinicians is this is just an estimate. In our lab, we use some very expensive research software in order to, keep track of our dietary logs, but that's because we're using it for research purpose. But there's nothing wrong with MyFitnessPal or some of the other apps that are really user-friendly for student athletes. So it's important just to do a three-day or seven-day dietary log just to track and see what are they intaking. And also to stress, not only what are you intaking through food, but what are you consuming through fluid? Athletes tend to forget about that, and it's very important that we also know what they're drinking, whether, you know, it's a lot of Gatorade or water. Some people may drink a lot of Cokes, but when we're dealing with student athletes at the collegiate level, although we want to pretend that they're not doing it, but they also some, not all, may also consume alcohol. So we also want to know what those calories are too. The other thing we can do is, in depending on resources, if they have a sports dietitian or a nutritionalist, they can go over those food log reports with them to help better guide what those recommendations are going to be for nutrition moving forward. And I highly recommend that they follow the guidelines that were set forth by the Academy of Nutrition Dietetics and ACSM for physically active populations, because they are different than the general population. The hardest part of figuring out energy availability, it's really going to be to determine how much they're expending through exercise. That's a really tough measurement to do, but we do some self-reporting measurements where the student athlete tells us, I practiced for this many hours, it was a light practice, it was a moderate practice, these were the skills that I did within that practice. Or they can also self-report, I ran 10 miles today and this was my time. You know, so you can self-report and use Ainsworth equation to change that into a MET, which then we can convert into calories. And the most easy thing to do is using just your Fitbit or, you know, your iWatches. There's so much technology today that can give you an estimate on how much you're expending during exercise. And so those are very user-friendly and can be used by anybody, and we just need to make sure athletic trainers can interpret what the data actually means.
So are there any other tools or resources that athletic trainers could use in the clinical setting to help with identifying and managing athletes with disordered eating?
Yeah, absolutely. The Female Athlete Triad Coalition has an outstanding website that gives a lot of information, and they also put up the most recent published literature to assist with anything that deals with any of the components to the triad. The NATA has a great position stand for eating disorders, disordered eating that athletic trainers can use. And then there's also the consensus statements as well as the position stand by ACSM and the Female Athlete Triad Coalition that can help better guide eating disorders as a component for diagnosis, treatment, and return to play. So those are all great resources. We're actually in the process right now of writing a position stand for the NATA specifically for the Female Athlete Triad and athletic trainers, and we don't anticipate that being done until probably within the next year or so.
Great. So I know that most athletic trainers are somewhat feel a little bit unprepared to manage some of these situations, and until you're really dealing with it from beginning to end, it's hard to really learn what it's like in the just from the class. So what are the most common misconceptions or mistakes that you see clinicians make in identifying and managing cases that you would want them to know up front?
I agree. When I teach our students, you know, we're very comfortable with traditional injuries. We're very comfortable identifying that ACL or that impingement in, you know, that third degree ankle sprain, but I call these non-traditional injuries. And to be honest, a lot of these, you know, coincide with each other. And it typically what happens is we end up, having a patient or a student athlete come in with a chronic injury or a stress fracture that hasn't healed in quite a bit. And so one of the common mistakes is, you know, they're just worried about treating the injury and getting them back to return to play from the injury instead of thinking outside the box. And I teach a class called evidence-based practice and weight management assessment. And one of the focuses of that class is to use nutrition as part of your rehabilitation to identify what student athletes or physically active populations are actually eating, because you have to fuel your body to be successful, not only in performance, but also with rehabilitation if you're returning to play from an injury. So I think it's very important for athletic trainers to identify what are they eating, what types of foods are they eating, what type of injury is this, and are there other things that can help with the healing process if they change their diet. And with that being said, also looking at their exercise and really looking at that student athlete holistically, because we focus so much on the student athlete in the moment of being an athlete. And then we also forget to ask questions about, well, so how are you doing outside of athletics? You know, how are your classes going? How's your family? How, you know, asking them questions that are outside of athletics. And this can be very important because those other outside stressors could be part of the cause of why they're not eating appropriately or why they're not healing appropriately. And so really making sure that we look holistically at the patient and not just the injury or just are they ready for performance.
What research do you think is still needed to advance clinical practice and the effectiveness of athletic trainers in managing athletes with these conditions?
I think one of the biggest things that's needed right now in the consensus statement from 2014 by D'Souza et al., they did a great job of really coming up with what's called the relative risk assessment plan. And just like any other plan that's used to identify an athlete's risk, we really need to start using it in clinical practice and identifying if this cumulative risk assessment really is sufficient and it is validated and reliable for assisting in the diagnosis of these student athletes and or physically active populations. And so I definitely think clinicians need to really start looking at these assessment tools and integrating them into clinical practice and looking at patient outcomes and really identifying, do we need to modify this? Because it may work for one patient where it may not work for another, or are we missing something? And so that would be one of my recommendations, is that we could do more research in that area of assessing these new assessment tools to see if they really are going to be feasible and reasonable in some of our clinical settings. The other thing is, you know, we focus so much on the female athlete triad, but what we're starting to see is some of the same trends that cross over to the male athlete. And Tenafort et al. Did a great study or a great paper that discusses the parallels of the female athlete triad and what now they're calling the male athlete triad. And so we definitely need to start looking at more studies and research and clinical assessments for the male athlete. And it's getting better every year. We see a little bit more research on the male athlete and finding that cutoff score for male athletes in terms of what is low energy availability. Right now, we've seen studies that range anywhere from 15 to 20 kilocalories per kilogram of fat-free mass for males, but it still doesn't have as much literature to support it as the female athlete triad for low energy availability. And the same thing goes for disabled bodies that are engaging in physical activity. We need to find some cutoff scores for them and also identify what are going to be their nutritional guidelines you know, as they expend energy differently, they use different body parts more frequently than others for exercise, just depending on what their disability is.
Well, I look forward to more of that research coming out so we can start to utilize this more in clinical practice and really having some of these prevention and screening tools. So you may have just addressed this, but as we wrap up this episode, can you provide your take-home message for how clinicians can use this information to improve patient outcomes?
Well, my take-home message would be what I mentioned before, is really starting to look at that patient holistically, making sure that they are mentally and physically ready to come back to return to play or return to work, depending on the setting that you're in. Looking beyond just the injury and making sure we're asking them about their dietary intake, and are they expending energy beyond what is just being asked for at practice? We find that often sometimes student athletes, you know, they're not going to practice while they're there because they're not supposed to, but on the side, they're still engaging in a lot of exercise and really just trying to get to know your patient and, you know, have a good understanding of what cultural competence is and be able to integrate all of those components with your patient care.
Well, Tony, thank you so much for your time and sharing all of your knowledge with us.
Thank you.
Well, that's it for today's The AT Tapes. Please remember to rate and subscribe to the podcast wherever you get your podcast. Please follow the Journal of Athletic Training on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at JAT_NATA on all three platforms. Thank you for listening, and I hope you will join us for next month's episode of the AT Tapes.